Why, save your calls until the half hour, and then we'll give you an opportunity to talk to our very special guest this evening. His name is Ambrose Evans Pritchard, and he was the bureau chief of the Sunday Telegraph in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And, of course, he's written an amazing, amazing book that you're going to want to get. It's called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, The Unreported Stories. Mr. Pritchard, are you there?
Hi.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. And I will have to admit, I was enthralled as I read your book. And I usually skim read books, I'll have to admit, doing as many interviews as we do. And I just couldn't skim read your book because there is just so much detail there and so much important information. And you're back in London now at the present time?
Well, I've started my new job covering economics and European currency union and all kinds of boring things like that. No more conspiracies for me now.
Well, anyway, what you've done, and I thought you really put it so well that, you know, America really is the hope of the world. We are the leader of the world and certainly the last hope for Western civilization, and how disillusioning it was for you to find out what was really going on in Washington, D.C.
Half disillusioning, because although I was very disappointed with the American leadership class, and I found that the elites, the baby boom elites sort of coming into power, I find very decadent and dishonorable in many ways, but the American people I still found were very impressive. So it was a sort of mixed feeling, and ultimately I'm convinced that the ordinary Americans will hold the line against this corruption, and they won't allow this to be grafted onto their republic.
Well, I believe that if there's any way we can reach the people, it'll be through books like yours that really give such a tremendous overview. So let's get started at the very beginning. And, of course, you start out with the story of the Oklahoma bombing and the quotation from Bill Clinton. The Oklahoma bombing was our common ground. And you give the quotation from the president, it broke a spell in the country as people began searching for our common ground again. And then, of course, you went on to say that Bill Clinton readily admitted that the Oklahoma bombing really changed his outlook and got his campaign going again there back in...
That's right. He told a group of reporters on Air Force One just after the election in 1996 that he owed the turnaround in his political fortunes to the Oklahoma bombing, which is quite a remarkable thing to say in many ways. But if you remember what it was like back in early 95, the Republicans were on the rampage. They'd taken both houses of Congress for the first time in 40 years. You know, the 100 days, the contract with America was all rushing through, and Clinton was talking plaintively about being relevant. And then the bomb went off. And suddenly all this anti-government rhetoric that had been flying around, some of it coming from the Republicans, some of it on talk radio. It suddenly, there was a certain feeling out there that maybe things had gone a bit too far. Maybe this had all had consequences. Maybe Tim McVeigh was the end result of all this talk. And although it was quite unfair to connect, obviously, the Republicans and talk radio to Tim McVeigh, Clinton exploited that brilliantly. And it had a certain resonance out in the country. And the Republicans were totally unable to respond. They just didn't know what to do. They were thrown off balance, and they never regained their balance. And Clinton just got into his stride and never looked back.
And, of course, you quoted Phil Gramm as saying, you know, you really shouldn't be blaming this on the Republicans, and he was being accused of being mean-spirited. Well, let's get into what you've really uncovered as far as the bombing, because your story is so entirely different than that came out of Denver and the trial of Timothy McVeigh. Where would you like to start on this? Do you want to start with some of the people who really did a lot of the research work on this, J.D. Cash, or do you want to get to Strassmeyer? Where do you want to start
in that
story?
Well, I think it's important for people to know that the position of the families themselves, the victims. I think most people assume that they're all agreed that the government's done a good investigation and they found the right people, but that's not true. That's not what the families feel. It's what some families feel, and the ones who are generally quoted and brought before the cameras. But there are many who don't feel that way at all. And I befriended one family in particular, Glenn and Kathy Wilburn, who lost two grandchildren in the daycare center. And they lost confidence in the Justice Department very early on. and conducted their own investigation for 2 years, collecting hundreds of hours of witness testimony, gathering documents from all over the place, and a great number of people were helping them. And what they really developed was a rival investigation to the FBI. And when I went down to Oklahoma and talked to them, and talked to Glenn Wilburn, who was an accountant and a very rational, practical man, I realized at once that this was somebody who knew what he was talking about. You know, he was not putting forward speculative theories. He was very hard-headed. And it was quite clear the government story did not add up. And the first point, obviously, was that there were more perpetrators. There were co-conspirators, accomplices, who had not been brought to justice. And they'd been shielded for some reason. We know that, obviously, there was Tim McVeigh, who was with there was John Doe 2, who was with Tim McVeigh when he rented the Ryder truck in Junction City, Kansas. Three of the staff there saw this mysterious John Doe 2 with McVeigh, and they've never retracted that story, contrary to press reports. All three still hold that there was a second man with McVeigh. And then there were other witnesses in both Junction City and in Oklahoma City on the day of the crime who saw McVeigh with other men, several other men. It's quite apparent that there was a terrorist cell here at work, involving perhaps as many as six people.
But, you know, the thing that's hardest for the average American to realize is that there could be a government cover-up of this magnitude, that agencies of the FBI all across America would be going around and not only questioning witnesses, but intimidating them, trying to get them to change their testimony, to deny saying what they had already said that they'd seen. In other words, trying to convince them that they hadn't seen what they actually had seen.
Well, that's right. You see, the agents were going around to these witnesses. I mean, most of these FBI agents were not, you know, they were perfectly, you know, straightforward. They were doing a good job. It doesn't take that many to start mucking something up. And you've got a few people who are corrupt or at least they're willing to compromise and engage in corrupt activities. And you can rig a whole investigation because you send them out to do the really sensitive interviews. And I think that's what happened here. They were going to these crime scene witnesses and trying to persuade them that what they saw wasn't what they saw, and they were hallucinating. And I list many of these witnesses in the book and quote them, what their experiences were with the FBI and how bitter they were. They felt the FBI was ignoring them, was trying to put words into their mouth, was trying to twist what they were saying.
And really, I think that's the beauty of your book, because you give instance after instance after instance of these various people either you have talked to or Glenn Wilburn had talked to. Let me just mention one thing you mentioned on page 21, which I'd never heard before, and that is that there is one suit led by the Wilburns with 170 Oklahoma family, members of the families of 170 people have joined this suit against the government for a cover-up. There's another suit with five families, and another suit with 300 families, members have joined a third suit, which basically says the FBI and ATF and other agencies of the U.S. government were involved in a failed sting operation. Now,
right.
Why haven't we heard about these lawsuits?
Isn't it amazing? Here you've got, now the 300 alleging it was a sting operation, that's in county court.
I see, right. But still, I mean, here there's 300 people tied into the bombing.
Absolutely, it's amazing. And then you've got this 170, which is the Wilburn lawsuit. Now that one is the biggest federal tort claim in history. You would have thought, here you've got the worst act of terrorism in U.S. history, followed by the biggest tort claim in history. You would have thought that the newspapers might report this fact. It's been completely ignored. I've never read about it in a single major newspaper in the United States.
Well, this is really what was so amazing about your book, because you had so many things I didn't know about, and I've certainly studied this quite closely. But, of course, as the whole story develops, it would appear that certainly Andre Strassmeyer, Dennis Mahan, Millar, who headed Elohim City, and Carol Howe were all government agents, many of them probably working for different agencies of government, all having infiltrated this white racist group, the Christian Identity Movement, and yet one agency of government covering up for the whole thing.
Yeah, it's amazing, because there's so many government agents inside this thing. They're all tripping over each other.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how this tied together, and then when the ATF wanted to arrest Strassmeyer, what happened?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. You see, what happened, I mean, looking at it from the point of view of the families, you see, they knew there were these other perpetrators, but, I mean, they didn't really know where to look. And not much came out in the McVeigh trial, I might add, too, because the judge deliberately prevented anybody from testifying who might have brought about collateral revelations. But what changed everything was last Christmas, when this undercover informant for the ATF, Carol Howe, came forward as a whistleblower in an interview with J.D. Cash from the Curtin Daily Gazette, who's been my other mentor in all of this, and terrific reporting. And what she said was completely stunning. She said that she had infiltrated this neo-Nazi group at Elohim City, this sort of paramilitary compound in eastern Oklahoma, and she'd stumbled on a terrorist campaign led by two men, Andreas Strassmayr, a German, and Dennis Mahan, this former Klan leader, who were talking about an escalating war against the U.S. government that would involve bombings, assassinations, and such like. And in fact, Strassmayr had talked about bombing federal buildings. And she'd reported all this to her case officer. Her case officer, at Angela Finley in Tulsa, has admitted this under cross-examination, under oath. There was talk of blowing up federal buildings by Strassmayr. Also, we got extensive information in her monthly reports, which have now become available. And there's no doubt that she was giving the ATF office in Tulsa a hair-raising account of what these people were planning to do. And the Tulsa office was very alarmed. So by this stage, Carol Howe had done some brilliant infiltration work. She managed to get Andreas Strassmayr on camera assembling hand grenades. So they decided they had enough to go in and arrest him. And so in February 95, they're about to do this. They started putting out feelers for interagency support. And the FBI immediately muscled in and closed down the whole thing. The first thing that the ATF office learned was that the Oklahoma State Police went to them and said, "Be careful, you've just stumbled into an FBI counterintelligence operation." And then the next day, they find out it's real, it's true, because there's a big damage control meeting in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tulsa. The regional director of the FBI comes up from Dallas. And they say, "What on earth are we going to do with this ATF investigation?" And they basically closed the whole thing down.
Now, this was probably 2 months or so before the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah, slightly less. It was about the 23rd of February.
So all right, fine.
Just under 2 months.
So you know, this is incredible. In other words, the government had their agents. In fact, it almost looks like all the key people, all the key players in this Christian identity, white racist, Aryan white racist group, were working for one or another government agency.
Well, what we don't know, by the way, the Justice Department has said categorically, until very recently, there were no U.S. government agents at this compound, period.
Right.
Well, that's a lie. We now know that Carol Howe was there for the ATF. The head of the community, Grandpa, as he's called, Pastor Robert Millar, it now transpires as working as an informant for the ATF, because that came out in court. The FBI admitted it. So that's two. There's another one for the ATF we've now learned about. Confidential informant 196 was also at Elohim City. That's three.
Now, do we know who he was?
No, we don't. Still trying to find out. He kind of replaced Carol Howe. They sort of overlapped for a while. And Strassmayr, who's being protected for some reason. Now, we don't know who he's working for, but we know the FBI muscled in to prevent him being arrested. So, okay, fine. Then 2 months later, the bomb goes off. Big problem. Carol Howe is called back in. She'd been put out to pasture, but they call her back in and they reactivate her as an informant. And she's debriefed at the Oklahoma Command Center of the FBI 2 days after the bombing. And she tells them that two of the Elohim ringleaders, Strassmayr and Mahan, had planned to blow up federal buildings, and furthermore, that Mahan had actually targeted three buildings, including the Oklahoma City federal building. So here you have a paid informant of the U.S. government telling them, in strictest confidence, at their request, at their command center, that Mahan had planned to blow up the building that had just been blown up. And furthermore, he had the technical capability to do so because he successfully detonated a 500-pound ammonium nitrate fertilizer bomb in Michigan, a truck bomb. Now, McVeigh and Nichols were never able to blow up anything, they tried to blow up a milk jug in the Arizona desert 6 months before the bombing, and it was a complete fiasco. They sprayed powder everywhere. They couldn't detonate a milk jug. And yet, 6 months later, they're supposed to have successfully detonated the biggest ammonium nitrate bomb in the history of U.S. terrorism, perfectly. Must have been 100% detonation because they left no residue anywhere. And they acted alone, and they did it all in one day.
But the interesting thing is that Mahan, Dennis Mahan, former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, is never investigated, is never questioned by the government.
Right. Well, if you were an FBI agent interested in Carol Howe, and they told you this, at this point you're still looking for John Doe 2 and all the other perpetrators. You've still got an open investigation. And you hear about a man who planned to blow up that building, and you had the technical capability to do so. You might want to go and pay the man a visit, I think. You go down the road to Tulsa and interview him. They never did.
That's the incredible thing. And they never investigated Strassmeyer until, a year or more after
Mahan, 2.5 years later, still has never been interviewed by any agency of the U.S. government about the Oklahoma bombing.
And yet, of course, he admitted in a drunken stupor, really to J.D. Cash, in effect, that he knew something about this, didn't he?
We'll get to that.
Okay, fine. I mean, there's so many parts of this that you've uncovered and put together in such a fascinating manner. Okay, I'll let you go ahead and tell the story.
But Strassmeyer, he's allowed to leave the country in his own good time and returns to Germany. And it's a year later, as you rightly said, he was telephoned by the FBI in a conference call, and they sort of said, where were you on the day of the bombing? I wasn't there. He said, oh, fine, good, end of story.
Right.
What we know, there are a number of things that are of interest here. That FBI document, the debriefing of Carol Howe, is an incredible document, and I've reprinted it in the back of my book, 21st of April, 1995. Every single name of importance is misspelled. Mahan is misspelled, Strassmeyer is misspelled, the pastor Robert Millar is misspelled, Elohim City is misspelled. Now, in the presence of the debriefing was the ATF case officer who had previously spelled all these names correctly on every single occasion. Now, the reason why these names are all misspelled was so that it would jam a computer search. In other words, the FBI was already covering it up right then. They knew perfectly well they were protecting these people. And when they misspell a name like that in that kind of document, you can be pretty sure that all those people work for the FBI or affiliated agencies in some form or another. Very briefly, there's an attempt to track down Strassmeyer straight after the bombing and investigate him. It goes on for a few days. The request put out to the German police and in German intelligence for information on Strassmeyer, because we got the cable traffic from the U.S. Embassy in Bonn to the Secretary of State in Washington talking about Strassmeyer in relation to the bombing, and then the paper trail just stops, just dries up completely. It's clear that some low-level people thought maybe we should look at Strassmeyer, and then they just shut it down. Again, he was being protected. He was obviously working at a high level, and I suspect that he's working for the CIA. The reason why I think that is that Tim McVeigh's lawyers requested all information from the U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies on Strassmeyer, whether he'd ever been a U.S. government informant or a source or agent of some kind. They all came back negative except the CIA, and that was so sensitive they refused to hand it over.
If there's nothing to conceal, then why are they concealing it?
Well, we don't know. You see, they gave it to the prosecution. The prosecution refused to hand it over to the defense.
But, in any law trial, you have the right of discovery. That's one of the basic principles of American law. The defense has the right to know what the prosecution knows. So why didn't they call a mistrial based on that?
It takes a judge to enforce. The judge told them to hand it over, and they just ignored the judge. And he's such a patsy that nothing happened. He didn't punish them. There was no sanction. I mean, the prosecution lied so many times about every important issue in this case. There was never any sanction against them. They've lied about so many things, like, for example, there being no informants at Elohim City. What's happened to them? Have they been disbarred? Nothing's happened.
And of course, the most frightening part of this was that the government then targeted Carol Howe and would have sent her to prison for an indefinite period of time. Here she was, a girl who had risked her life for America. She really believed in America. She was trying to make a better America. She had infiltrated at the government's behest this group of terrorists who were planning on bombing and disrupting our country, and yet, in an effort to keep her from getting the truth out about the fact that the government knew about the bombing, they indicted her falsely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What they did there was absolutely disgraceful. The moment she started talking to Cash, John Cash, they obviously had a wiretap on her, in case she'd do this. And within days, they busted her house, the FBI did. Now, at this point, she's still on the active roster of the ATF as an informant. The FBI claimed they didn't know this, and I just think that's a complete lie. They then hold the possibility of charges over her. And since she won't shut up, they then indict her 3 months later.
In other words, this was all an effort to intimidate her, using the law to intimidate her so she wouldn't tell the truth about what she knew about the bombing.
Exactly. And then they indicted her in order to discredit her before the McVeigh trial, in case she was called as a witness. As it happened, the judge wouldn't allow her to testify. So, therefore, he gutted the whole defense strategy. Because the whole defense strategy was to say, look, these boys at Elohim City blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building, not McVeigh. And they weren't allowed to present that case. And by the way, I think McVeigh's guilty. I think the whole thing is one. I think McVeigh was part of that group. So they then indict her. And they indict her. They say that she had a pipe bomb in her house. Which is true. She had the materials for a pipe bomb. The only problem was, it turned out in her trial that the pipe and the fuse and the powder had all been collected during her duties for the ATF. It was all logged and authorized.
Right, and of course, they knew that, but they hoped that they could use the threat of sending her to prison to silence her.
Right.
And when the court and the judicial system is used to intimidate American citizens to keep from letting the American public know the truth, then no man's freedom is really secure. And this is what's really so frightening about your book.
Yeah, I think it was a very serious abuse of the criminal justice machinery, misuse of it. And, luckily she was acquitted by a Tulsa jury. And, of course, one of the reasons she was acquitted is that her family are very rich. Her father was a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, MAPCO. Very wealthy, well-connected family. And he's also he wasn't going to let his daughter just be crushed in this way. And he got very, very good counsel. And he ran rings around these assistant U.S. attorneys who were trying to lock her up. And the government case collapsed, and it was very humiliating. She'd had a public defender. I'm not quite sure whether she would have fared so well. But there we are. They fired and missed, and now the settling of accounts is going to go on. Those people who persecuted her with this malicious prosecution are going to pay a high price, I can assure you that. And those U.S. attorneys, the U.S. attorney in Tulsa, the assistant U.S. attorneys, they're going to wish they never did that. And the FBI counterintelligence, or counterterrorism rather, highest levels in Washington who are behind this whole thing and orchestrated it, are also going to pay a price. So you've got to be careful who you pick on.
Well, I certainly hope that you're right. I just hope that the American people will be aroused by your book and will demand that we get Congress in and begin to investigate this whole rotten, rotten mess. Well, of course, the whole part of this story really sort of culminates with your personal contact and conversations with Andreas Strossmayer. Do you want to bring that out yet, or is there anything else we should bring
in? It's kind of interesting because you see the families. The Wilburns, tragically, Glenn Wilburn died of pancreatic cancer this summer, so he didn't see the fruit of all his work. But what is his wife and daughter and other families involved in this believe is that the reason why all this has been covered up is because some of these other perpetrators are government agents. They think the biggest candidate for this is obviously Andreas Strassmayer. And the reason they think this is because of his extraordinary background. First of all, he comes from a very prominent German family. His father was parliamentary secretary of state to the chancellor, and head of the ruling CDU for Berlin. Andreas himself was a West German army officer for 8 years, He had intelligence training. He was acting battalion intelligence officer in the Panzer Grenadiers, and one of his jobs was turning Warsaw Pact agents and using them to feed to disinformation back to the East Bloc. He told me all this. And he came to the United States to work undercover for the U.S. Justice Department. He was going to get a job with the DEA penetrating the cocaine cartels. So this is rather interesting. Now, he says the job fell through when he got to the United States for a variety of reasons. And he instead became a sort of vagabond tourist and wandered around the country and ended up with these neo-Nazis and became their chief of paramilitary training and basically set up a terrorist boot camp there where the terrorist wing of the Aryan Nations movement would come by for training in from all over the country. And so he was there for about 4 years at the very nexus of the American far right. Perfect place to gather intelligence, by the way. Now, we're supposed to believe that he went from being this German intelligence, military intelligence officer who'd come to the country to work undercover for the Justice Department, suddenly transforms into this virulent neo-Nazi who's stirring up a race war against the U.S. government. I find this transition a little implausible. It seems to me that he was all this rhetoric that he was engaging in at Elohim City, in which Carol Howe documented very carefully, provided back to the ATF, was maintaining his cover. He was just bluster. He was putting himself at the head of all this insurrectionary, racist warfare in order to penetrate it better, I think. And more important, this is what many of the families now think. And it would explain why he was protected, why the FBI wouldn't allow the ATF to arrest him.
Well, do you think he was an agent provocateur? In other words, he was egging people on to blow up buildings because he wanted them to blow up buildings, because that then would create the crime that the government could move against.
Well, I don't think anybody wanted the building to actually go to blow up. I think that... I don't know. I mean, we're getting into the realm of speculation here. What he told me, and we had a lot of long conversations, and he got very emotional. And I think this was in the spring of 96, and I think at that point he was thinking of coming forward and telling the truth. But he couldn't quite bring himself to do it. And then subsequently he just backed away and went underground completely and wouldn't talk anymore. But at that moment he started saying all kinds of things, and one of the things he told me is, firstly, the government was given everything they needed to intercept that bomb, and they bungled it. And the way he put it was, they waited too late. They should have arrested them while they were building the bomb, and instead they wanted a big publicity stunt. They wanted to catch them, you know, in flagrante at the site. And, of course, there's a huge risk in doing that, and then they lost control somehow.
And, of course, this is all quoted in the book. Did you actually record this conversation?
Unfortunately, I didn't. I wish I had now, because, it's actually illegal to record from Maryland, where I live.
I see.
And I had to do these very early in the morning in German time to get him. Because of the six-hour difference. So I was calling from my home at sort of 6 in the morning or something. And so I didn't record them. Obviously, I wish, if I realized how important they were going to become, I would have. You know, I was always planning to get on the plane and go to Berlin and then do all this in person. And then by then I'd lost him. He'd gone. He wouldn't talk to me anymore. So it was one of those sort of fleeting things. And I had about 6 conversations with him on the telephone, some of them lasting 2 or 3 hours.
But you certainly recorded beautifully exactly what he said. I'm sure you...
I took notes, and then I had to reconstruct it as best I could afterwards.
And of course, the conversation here is, if anybody reads this and doesn't realize that Strassmayer was involved in this whole thing, and he was really afraid to tell. In fact, there's one quotation you have from Strassmayer saying, talking about a provocateur, and then said, what if he talked and manipulated the others into it? What then? The country couldn't handle it. The relatives are going to go crazy. He's going to be held responsible for the murder of 168 people. That is a frightening statement.
Yes, you see, what I kept saying to him was, I think you're a hero. I think you're a very brave man. You did your job. you tried to penetrate some very dangerous people. They would have killed you if they found out who you really were. You did your best to stop this bombing, and why didn't you come forward and tell the truth? What? A provocateur? And he said, the informant can't come forward. What happens if he manipulated them into doing this thing?
And then,
of course, would go berserk.
Sure, and 168 people die. And that is one of the most dramatic parts of the whole, at least the story of the Oklahoma bombing, and a story which, interestingly enough, I even read part of that in the Oklahoma newspaper, the one that's been so critical of Representative Charles Key and has attacked anybody who suggested there was a conspiracy, and yet they actually quoted part of what you said in that.
We did the Daily Oklahoman?
Yes.
Did they do this?
Oh, I've got it probably about 2 weeks ago when I first heard about your book.
Oh, I had no idea they'd written that.
Right, and they even talked about they didn't actually quote that part of it, but they talked about how Strassmeyer had actually been protected by the Justice Department. They didn't mention specifically the FBI, but the Justice Department had intervened in this whole effort to arrest Strassmeyer back in 2 months before the bombing. So, the fact that they would come out with that really, to me, was amazing.
That is interesting, yeah. I mean, I think it's quite clear now what happened. I mean, I think that Strassmeyer probably got wind of some kind of bombing conspiracy while he was there at Elohim City, while he was training all these people. And then he kind of inserted himself into it in order to gain better intelligence. And to be able to do that successfully, he would have had to be seen to be one of the most militant instigators of it. Because otherwise it wouldn't have worked. Otherwise he would have been transparently been seen as an agent. And then I think, who knows how much information he had. But he may not have had every detail, you see. He may not have had the exact time, and the exact target. And what's important to know here is that the organization which the families now believe conducted this thing was called the Aryan Republican Army. It was a military terrorist wing of the Aryan Nations movement, and it was modeled on the IRA. By their own admission, they say that. Now, not ideologically, of course, but in terms of its methods. The IRA being the premier terrorist movement in Europe, the most professional group of terrorists. Really good. And they modeled it on them. They studied their methods. They used their cell structure, communication system, and all that. And so they were quite adept, actually. And they had a very compartmentalized system. I think you had cells where not everybody knew what the others were doing. See, I don't think McVeigh knew everything. It's one of the reasons why he's not talking. But he can't. He only knows his bit. Although there may be other reasons why he's not talking, maybe because they threatened to kill his family, but that's another matter. Strassmeyer, I think, was involved in part of it. And he had inklings of what was going on, information coming through, and he was probably passing this on to the CIA, who would have passed it on to the FBI. But not enough, perhaps, to crack it completely, and hence you have all these clear indications in Oklahoma City that they knew something was coming. There were warnings to the fire department. They had bomb squads out there that morning. Some federal officials were warned not to come in that day, and so forth. But they didn't know exactly what was coming, and I think that's probably what happened. But the thing is, they've lied about everything, so we don't know. We're having to piece the jigsaw together one piece at a time because they won't tell the truth about anything.
Well, you've certainly done a yeoman's job in getting that story. That's certainly the best summary of it I've read at all. Did you ever run into Bill Jasper, who was doing a certain amount of research for...
Yes, no, I have. I've met Joe Jasper, and I think he's done some very, very good work.
Well, I think that this is... your book, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, puts this together better than anybody else has. Well, we could talk, for hours just about Oklahoma, but then we wouldn't get to so much of the rest of the book. So let's basically get a touch on the story of Vince Foster and the strange death of Vince Foster. And obviously, the government is not, once again, telling us the truth.
Right. People seem to think that now that Ken Starr has issued his report, saying that it was a suicide, there's nothing to it, that the matter is closed. But it's really not closed. It hasn't made any difference. First of all, I might note that no prosecutor put his name to that report. At least with the Fisk report, you know, they all signed it. You could see who they all were. Nobody's put their name to this thing. None. John Bates, who's head of the Washington office, is the real author of it, and Brett Kavanaugh, his assistant. Their names don't appear anywhere in the documents.
Well, what about Starr's name? Does it appear?
Well, Starr doesn't either.
I see. So it's sort of an unsigned report, but we want to assure the American people that we've looked into it. It was just a suicide.
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, they're so ashamed of that report that then, you know, all these anonymous prosecutors. I mean, Starr obviously has got his, you know, everybody knows that he's, because he's, you know, he's the public figure. But all these other ones, they're too embarrassed to put their name to it. What people need to know is that the prosecutor who was in charge of the case,
Miguel Rodriguez.
Miguel Rodriguez from California, whose family actually comes from near you, around the San Jose area. He conducted a 4 or 5 month investigation, reopened the case, used a grand jury, and uncovered serious evidence of foul play. But as he was trying to pursue the leads, he discovered he was being obstructed by the FBI in his own office, who, by the way, had been kept on from the previous Fisk investigation. So the same FBI agents were reviewing their own work. Clearly, they had a vested interest in maintaining the cover-up. So Rodriguez went to Ken Starr and said, I can't do my work. They're putting up roadblocks. We've got a cover-up here, and I need your backing if we're going to do this thing at all. And Ken Starr just didn't want to listen. He didn't want to know about it. The whole thing was just too big. It was not doable. It would mean confronting the Washington establishment. It would mean confronting the FBI and the Justice Department and the power structure, and it's not Ken Starr's instinct to do that. So he just looked the other way, and Rodriguez resigned in disgust, went back to California, Sacramento, and his assistant resigned in sympathy, and that was that, the end of the Starr, end of the Foster investigation. So this silly report that they've just issued, it's the result of 2.5 years after that of damage control, of desperately trying to find something that could buttress the theory of suicide. The problem is there's not much evidence that substantiates suicide. What they've done is they come up with a theory and then try to make the facts fit the theory, and the facts don't fit the theory. And I might say, a couple of things about this Starr report. Firstly, if you can believe this, there's always been problems with a gun found in Foster's hand, because nobody in the family has ever been able to identify it. And indeed, the first person who arrived at the crime scene, a confidential witness, said there was no gun in the hand. But Starr comes up with this oven glove, which he says the gun was transported in, and there was evidence of lead in there and so forth. And the oven glove was found in the glove compartment of the car, Foster's car. Well, you know where this glove came from. It was produced 10 months after the death by White House aide and Rose Law Firm musketeer Bill Kennedy. This isn't evidence. There's no chain of custody on this. He turns up with his oven mitt and says, "Oh, by the way, this was in the car too. Forgot to tell you." And they're treating this as a crucial piece of evidence to substantiate their report.
That reminds me of the suicide note with 27 pieces, no fingerprints on it. It wasn't written by Foster, you know, and how they could get away with that. That's what's so amazing.
The thing is, this oven mitt, there's a list, there's an inventory of evidence. Everything they found in the glove compartment of that car is listed in great detail, including a guitar pick and various other things. No mention of the oven glove. And when the two park police detectives who searched that car were interviewed under oath in a deposition, they both said they found nothing unusual in the glove compartment. Nobody ever mentioned an oven mitt. It was never in any of the records or inventory of evidence. It just came out of the blue 8-10 months later, and they treat this as major evidence. I think this should give people some indication of how desperate Starr's people were to find something. Yeah, and it just shows how dishonest they are.
What about the story of the confidential witness? Because this was the man who first found the body, and then, and that's an amazing, amazing story. Would you want to just recount some of that?
It's kind of interesting. You know, he when he arrived, the palms of Foster's hands were up on both sides. His arms were sticking straight down by his sides, palms up, and there was no gun. And he's a country boy, and he's not squeamish about bodies. So he stopped and looked very hard. He was there for several minutes. He looked around. He didn't really see any blood, so he wondered what was wrong with Foster. And he just saw a tiny little bit of blood underneath the nose, dried blood. He thought it was quite old, actually. And then he searched for a weapon, and he couldn't find one. He looked very closely. There was no weapon. You can imagine his surprise the next day when he finds out from the newspapers that his brother tells him, oh, by the way, that dead body you saw up there, it was the Deputy White House Counsel, close friend of the President and the First Lady. Oh, and by the way, there was a gun in the hand.
Well, of course, I think for our listeners who don't understand, this gentleman was driving a white van, and he ran down, telephoned the report in, and then just took off, didn't give his name, address. He didn't want to get involved in this.
Right, that's right. He just told a couple of park police, no, park service workers, you know, there's a body up in the park, without giving his name.
Right.
So when his brother says, look, you said there was no gun. But they're saying there was a gun, and they're saying he's a top White House official. And at this point, the confidential witness says, oh, my God. And his brother says, now, listen here, boy. You don't ever say a word about this to anybody. There's something really fishy here, and you don't want to get in the middle of it. So for several months, he didn't get in the middle of it. He kept silent. And then a news story was published in the New York Daily News, which is very close to the White House, by the way, saying that the whole story of this man in the white van was totally untrue. It had been concocted by the Park Service workers trying to explain the fact that they were actually playing truant from their jobs up at the park and having a drink when they shouldn't have been. So they came up with this story about the man in the white van. And the confidential witness didn't like the sound of this at all. First of all, they put a gun in the hand suddenly, and now he was being disappeared. He was being eliminated from the scene, and this made him very, very worried. I think he was seriously concerned that if they found out who he was, he'd be killed. So at that point, he came forward to G. Gordon Liddy, the radio host and Watergate protagonist. He knew that Liddy would not betray his identity, but he wanted to get his story out for his own security, so he went on the radio show anonymously. And then Liddy actually persuaded him eventually to talk to the FBI. And the FBI tried to get him to change his story, tried to get him to say, well, there was a gun, it was hidden underneath a hand. They went through this about 20 times. He kept saying, no, no, there was no gun. They said, well, yes, there was. And then eventually they said to him, well, supposing the gun was, the hand flipped over, and the gun was underneath the hand, and all that was visible was the tiny bit of the trigger guard around the thumb. And he said, well, I suppose if that's what happened, it's possible I didn't see the gun. So they then misconstrued what he said into saying, well, the gun was hidden and so forth. Then he saw the leaked photo, the photograph leaked to ABC News.
And there's the gun just as big as life.
There's the gun clearly visible. You can see a bit of it's hidden, but at least half of it's clearly visible. And furthermore, it was in a different position. The hands were in a different position from the way he'd found the body. Completely different. The whole crime scene was different. And he was furious. He said, I've been had. They tricked me. So, when the Star investigation spoke to him, the head of the Star office in Washington, it was then a fellow called Mark Toohey, invited him over to the Metropolitan Club along with another junior prosecutor, and they talked to him for an hour and a half, and he told them, look, he said there was no gun, and I was tricked by Robert Fisk, and I'm not going to be tricked again. I'm not having you monkeying with my testimony. There was no gun, period, and I want that in the report, no nonsense. So about 10 days ago, I had dinner with him in Washington, And I showed him the Star report, which he'd not seen before. I showed him the section about him, and he just threw a fit. Because once again, they'd done the same thing. They'd said, well, the confidential witness wasn't sure, and maybe the gun was hidden underneath the hat. He said, the bastards, he said, they'd done it again. So here's the confidential witness. His testimony is falsified. We've got the second witness there, Patrick Knowlton, second key crime scene witness. He actually was there a bit earlier in the evening, and he saw two things that are very, very important. First of all, he saw a man on guard at the entrance to the park, basically acting as if he was preventing anybody going into the park, which is incredibly suspicious. And secondly, he saw what was supposed to be Vince Foster's car, a Honda with Arkansas plates. The problem was it wasn't Foster's car. It was a different color, different model, and different age, completely different car. And they tried to get him, the FBI, under the Fisk investigation, tried to get him to change his story so that it would look more like Foster's car. And he refused to change it. And he was adamant, because he's a stubborn Irishman, and he just wouldn't change a word of it. I kept on insisting. So they say, all right. So 2 weeks later, they call him back a second time. He comes in from Virginia. And when he comes in, he parks his car outside the Vietnam War Memorial. Somebody gets out with somebody follows him for several blocks, parks behind him, takes out a tire iron and smashes his car up, Patrick Knowlton's car up, the witness's car. Just smashes the lights out. Does it in front of witnesses. The witnesses got the number plate. We tracked him down, and we know exactly who he is. And guess what?
He's a government employee of some sort.
He works for the FBI.
Oh, what, you wonder why the FBI would be doing things like that? That's the sort of thing they do in Nazi Germany.
They send a goon out to smash his car up to intimidate him so that he would get a message.
But isn't he the man who was just constantly followed harassed for
weeks? Yes, more to come, you see. But at this point, Patrick Knowlton was still, I mean, he was a little naive, I suppose. He didn't get the message. He didn't understand why they were doing it to his car. Of course, he didn't know the guy worked for the FBI. But so he comes in for his second set of testimony to the FBI. And he still refuses to change the story about the car. So they say, okay, fine, thank you, Mr. Knowlton. He goes on home. And they simply change the testimony. They rewrite it. They just lie about what he'd said in his FT-302 statement. But Knowlton didn't know this until a year and a half later when I found him and showed him his witness statements. And he looked at them and he had an apoplectic fit. He said, what are they? He said, I never said this. He said, I can't believe this. I can't believe they've written this down. I specifically told them this was not true. I wrote an article for the Telegraph in London about him accusing the FBI of being liars, and it caused a bit of a sensation. The Kenneth Starr immediately subpoenaed Knowlton to appear before the Washington grand jury, Whitewater grand jury. And the day he received his subpoena, he came under intense harassment, and it continued for 2 days. They were running into him bumping into him in the streets. They were banging on his door at night. They were telephoning him at all hours of the night. I mean, it was 2 days of intense harassment to destabilize him, drive him out of his mind. And there were a number of witnesses to this. It definitely happened, in my opinion.
Well, now, didn't Chris Ruddy, didn't he see some of this? Or?
Yeah, he did. I mean, what happened was it began his girlfriend, who's, you know, she's a PhD in management, a very sort of sound, straightforward person, and you know, she doesn't see shadows on the walls. She was the first person to realize what was going on. She was with him, and it developed that evening as they're walking around DuPont Circle in Washington. And then Patrick Knowlton called me that night. He said this, the whole thing's going bananas. They're banging on the door, they're doing all kinds of things. And I calmed him down, and eventually he said, okay, he'd try to go to sleep. Things sort of stopped. The next day, Chris Ruddy was in town, and Chris went out for a walk with him, and it happened again. Chris called me up on his cell phone and said, you won't believe what's going on here. There are about 25 men in this net doing all this stuff, trying to scare the wits out of this guy. And then that night, it happened again. It got worse. Patrick Knowlton called me up in Maryland and said he couldn't bear it anymore. He's going to go bananas. He wanted out of the whole thing. He didn't care. He just wanted the whole thing to stop.
This is exactly the same techniques they used on the people at Waco, you know, with the constant sound and rabbits screaming and lights flashing and everything to disorient the people.
Yeah, it is actually. It's a little bit like what they did to some of the left in the 60s too.
Right.
I mean, it's a goon method.
This was a man who was going to testify, supposedly to tell the truth, and yet somebody is coordinating this effort to intimidate him.
Well, only a tiny group of people knew about it. The prosecutors in the Star's office and the FBI agents who delivered the subpoena, the only people who knew about it.
Right.
So it was leaked. Or it was the FBI itself, which is what Knowlton thinks. And then he was called before the grand jury, and it was a complete fiasco. It was quite clear they were just trying to destroy his credibility. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he was so angry about it all, he eventually filed a lawsuit against the FBI, and against some of the harassers, because we tracked down a couple of them, for violating his civil rights, for witness tampering and intimidation.
And what's ever happened to that lawsuit?
Well, it's in the courts, and what is very interesting, we're waiting for the judge to see he must rule now whether the case can go ahead. And they've been waiting for that for weeks. What is interesting here is Patrick Knowlton and his lawyer, John Clark, who's sort of devoted himself full time to this, wrote a long report, basically deconstructing and debunking the Fisk report. And when Ken Starr's report came out, they asked this to be submitted as an addendum. And the panel of three judges who appointed Ken Starr, said, yes, let's include it. And Starr was furious about this. He fought it every step of the way. He said that since Patrick Knowlton was not named, they used a code instead of a name in the report, that he had no right to this. And the panel of three judges simply overruled him and acceded to every one of Patrick Knowlton's demands. And that is now included as an official part of the Starr report. 20-page addendum.
How can my listeners get the Starr report?
Well, you can get it from the Office of the Independent Counsel.
All right.
In Washington, or in Little Rock, and just request a report. They'll send it. Actually, it's in two volumes. The second volume includes the Knowlton addendum. But this is the first time in the history of the special prosecutor this has ever happened, that any report like that has been included as an addendum. And what it signifies is a complete slap in the face for Ken Starr.
But you see, we've never heard that, and I'm sure that most of the listeners of this program have never heard the story of Patrick Knowlton before, or the fact that his appendum is actually on the back of the Fisk report, because the media hasn't told us that.
Well, that's right. It's been a complete blackout on this. But it's an extraordinary story, and it's an extraordinary story of the American spirit, really. Here's an ordinary guy who fought back. He wasn't going to let them do this to him. You know, they trampled on him. They violated his civil rights. They tried to intimidate him. Through different means. They tried to make him change his testimony. And the reason, and I didn't really get into this, but the real problem here, I realized, was they can't get around this car. Foster's car wasn't at the crime scene. The body got there before the car. And so they're desperate about it. They're desperate to make it look as if the car was there first. Foster arrived in his own car. But if, and it's quite clear that Knowlton is right, because all the other original crime scene witnesses saw the same car that Knowlton saw. This old rust brown 1983 or 84 Honda, which doesn't fit Foster's car at all. Foster's was a much newer silver 1989 Honda. Much sleeker kind of model. All the original witnesses saw the car Knowlton saw. Foster's car simply wasn't there. until later that evening. Either they switched the cars or something happened, but there was some hanky-panky there. And of course, the car keys, and that's another story. Can you believe it? I mean, Forster had 6 keys in his pocket on 2 rings. Big, big clump of metal, including a Medico high security lock for one of the safes in the council's office. And the park police officer searched his trouser pockets. No keys. 3 hours later, or 2 hours later, at the morgue, the keys turn up. When the park police go over to the morgue at the Fairfax County Hospital, there are the keys in the pocket. In the meantime, White House aide Bill Kennedy, Rose Laufer, musketeer of the oven mitt fame, Craig Livingston, the bar bouncer from Pittsburgh, who was later involved in the 900 FBI files, remember him?
Yes, yes.
The snafu. Those two go over to the morgue, and not only do they get inside the room. You're supposed to view the body through the glass if you're not a family member, or even family members do. In fact, they got inside the room itself, and they got inside the body bag. It was unzipped, and they got to look at the body right there. And then the keys turn up.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Now the Star reporters lied about this, as they lied about everything else. They said that the park police arrived before the White House staff. That's just not true. The hospital staff are adamant that the White House guys got there first. And if you look at the chronology, the timeline, it's clear that Kennedy must have been there at least half an hour before the park police. So somebody put his keys in the pocket.
Well, you know, we can go back to the Kennedy assassination, when the magic bullet suddenly appears on the gurney, and and this supposedly is the bullet that went through Kennedy and Connolly, and of course they use these same things over and over again because nobody calls them on it. I mean, it's obvious that somebody planted the keys, in Vince Foster's pocket. After all, how could he get to the Fort Marcy Park if he hadn't driven himself? If he was going to commit suicide, unless...
Yeah, I mean, what were these people doing with the keys to his car in the first place?
Surely.
I mean, what was going on here? Why was his car not there? Why was his other brown car there, babysitting or whatever it was doing? What was Bill Kennedy doing with the car keys? I mean, the whole thing just reeks. I just realized here that it's coming up to the hour.
And I have another
interview.
All right, fine. Well, I'm going to have to let you go, but
we'll have to do a second one and get to the other part of the book.
Do you have any time in the next few days?
We'll have to arrange it, but I'd like to get back and finish this off.
All right, fine. Well, maybe I could give you a call first thing in the morning and we could find some time that we could, because you're a fascinating guest. You've got a wealth of information, and we want to get that out across the country. Look, the book again for our listeners, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. Our guest has been Ambrose Evans Pritchard, the author of it. And, of course, we could talk for hours, but I know that it's at midnight back there, and you must be exhausted.
But anyway, thanks, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was certainly one of the great interviews, and I hope that many of you, if you didn't record this or want to get copies of it, we're going to be broadcasting this, of course, in the East. We'll be broadcasting this, I think, on our day program and our shortwave program, because we want to get this information out, and I'm going to try to call Mr. Pritchard first thing in the morning and see if we can't line him up for another interview before he goes back to London, because the thing, once he's back in London investigating the European Common Market, we're not going to have a chance to talk to him. Well, we have a fascinating guest for you this next hour. Don't even think about turning out that dial, because we'll have Karen Holgate talking about some of the incredible things that are happening in education. But you see, it all ties in together. It is all an effort to change the America that we live in. And of course, if they can get away with what happened in Oklahoma, what happened to Vince Foster, why no man's life is safe.